I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Public radio lovers, take note. Today we'll hear my great conversation with the Lord of Lake Wobegon, the Prince of Powder Milk Biscuits, and the Viceroy of Variety, Mr. Garrison Keeler. We'll find out what he's been up to since leaving a Prairie Home Companion, and I'll ask him about the Love and Comedy tour that's bringing him to town. Then a history of mob violence in the city of Fountains. We'll find out how and why the mafia thrived in post-war Kansas City and managed to keep a foothold in the city into the 1980s. Brian McTavish wraps things up with a weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Garrison Keeler is back on the road where he's spent so many summers. This time it's for his Love and Comedy tour that will bring him to Kansas City on August 29th. Never mind that, as he's indicated publicly any number of times, he's now 75. The Love and Comedy tour is long and winding. It'll take him to every corner of the country, 28 cities in all. Garrison Keeler joins us now, and it's great to have you back, Garrison. It's great to hear your voice again.
Well, okay, then I'll talk. I'll speak. I'll speak words.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm doing great. Just working on a couple of books and screenplay. You know, that sort of thing. When you have time, you turn to the long distance.
It occurs to me that this is as good a time of year for you as any time of year, with all the sweet corn out there and all those fresh tomatoes. I mean, what is it about fresh tomatoes at the farmer's market, which you just can't get enough of right now?
There's such an enormous long step away from manufactured tomatoes. Tomatoes that you buy in supermarkets, usually they're small tomatoes. They're strip mined, I don't know, down in Texas or Arizona somewhere. But you taste something. You have to be suspicious of the label homegrown. But you can smell them, and there just is an air of mystery and revelation about a fresh tomato. It's impossible to explain to someone who's not had one. Evidently, you have not had one lately.
Yes, I have, and you have. You don't want to refrigerate them, though, right?
No, I don't think you should. I think it squelches the aroma.
How does it feel to be heading back out on the road again?
It feels good. I feel like doing it one more time because you know, I come from a background that encourages regret. And so you look back over 42 years of doing a show and you feel a lot of regret. And so I feel like going out and doing something right and making up for it. And that's what I intend to do. We're going out with Fred Newman, our sound effects guy, so we can do, you know, a wild range of drama. We can do horses and mutant dolphins and, you know, submarines and meteorites heading toward Earth. We can do everything. And then there's a beautiful tall woman to sing duets with, Aoife O'Donovan, and then there's a band. Darn good band. And from that, you can do pretty much everything I would want to do. There's, of course, the news from Lake Wobegon, where things do change. And so there's that to be gone into. And just, I want to talk about, you know, the goodness of life. And I want to walk out into a crowd again and sing My Country 'Tis of Thee with them. People like that. Mm-hmm. The simplest thing in the world to do, and people like that. They like to sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic and John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt and Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
You know, when it comes to Lake Wobegon itself and the news there, have there been any front page stories since you went off the air regularly that we should be aware of before you come to town, or anything big happening there?
No, Lake Wobegon avoids the front page. The front page these days belongs to Washington. And
yes, it does.
And Lake Wobegon is content to stay back in the shadows. But things do change. For one thing, there's a beautiful tomato crop this year, and people still sit around in the cafe and they tell stories about embarrassing things that happen to people other than themselves.
You know, what do you like most about being on the road? You've mentioned a couple of things here, but I look at your tour schedule, Garrison, and it looks daunting. I mean, 28 cities, that's a lot of road time.
It gives you a lot of chances to sing the songs that you that you like. It gives you a chance to stand up there and sing the Stars and Stripes Forever with new words. And it gives you a chance to wend your way through the news from Lake Wobegon. The show changes a lot in the course of 28 days, and I like that. I like improv.
Those first few Saturdays when you didn't have to be at a theater at 5 o'clock, how did that feel to you?
It felt like an addition to Sunday. It felt like an additional Sunday. But I stayed busy. I get up early in the morning. I sit down at a laptop. I always have about 10 projects to work on. I started work on Saturdays on my newspaper column. I write a newspaper column now, a weekly column, which I really enjoy. And so I just did not think about it.
Doing the show offered you, I'm sure, a very predictable routine to your work week. Did you find yourself just keep chugging along when it was gone, or did you find yourself drinking that second cup of coffee?
I've always drunk the second cup of coffee and also the third, but I got engrossed in working on this screenplay. It's a Lake Wobegon screenplay, and you discover writing a long work that nothing is ever finished. You keep coming back to it, and you keep changing it, and it gets better. At least you think that it does. The radio show was finished, you know, when it went off the air. Mm-hmm. You were done with it, and it's locked up, and then will be repeated, you know, forever on, you know, for hundreds of years. But but the work that I'm, this memoir that I'm working on, kind of a memoir of gratitude, is it's never ending, and you discover so much that had never occurred to you. You learn about your parents in trying to write about them and their lives. You go back to points in your life that you had never thought about before, where everything could have gone another direction. Mm-hmm. And so you get engrossed in these things, and it's good to have the time. And it's also good to get away from management. I never was good at management, and nobody is really. And so it's a relief to be done with that.
When are we going to read the memoir?
You are going to read it whenever you pick it up. You know, I mean, it'll be in your library eventually. It'll be
when?
Over there in the memoir section. I don't know. I hope it comes out in a year or so, but I don't know. I have a book of limericks coming out from Grove Press in the spring, most of them clean, and so I'm just putting the finishing touches on that.
And the screenplay, and the screenplay, has that been sold? Or are we going to see that in a movie theater sometime?
I certainly hope that you will, because it's not so great reading it, you know, in a script. So I hope it will be up on the screen, and you'll get to see Lake Wobegon. You'll get to see the Mercantile and the Sidetrack Tap and Bunsen Motors and all the rest of them.
Garrison Keillor brings his Love and Comedy tour to Kansas City's Uptown Theater at 8 o'clock Tuesday evening, August 29th. Fred Newman, Rich Dworsky will be joining him, lots of others as well. More information, uptowntheater.com. You know, we just talked on the show the other day about Amelia Earhart, because she's from just up the river here, and you just wrote a column about her, and it bothers you that we still don't know what became of her, and I think that still bothers a lot of people out there.
Atchison, she was from.
Atchison, right? That's right.
Yeah. Well, she was a heroine of my youth, even though I was born 5 years after her plane disappeared in the South Pacific. But I've thought of her often, and she's so becoming in old newsreels, that smile and that short-clipped hair. She really was a very modern woman. So I'm working on a theory that...
I know where you're going here.
I'm working on a theory that Howard Hughes rescued her from the Pacific and took her to live at the Desert Inn in Las Vegas, where she gave birth to a child in August of 1942. And if that turns out to be the truth, I'll have to accept it, that's all.
I'm wondering about how you feel about the success of public radio these days. I mean, record audiences for NPR and so many of the member stations across the country, including this one. Prairie Home Companion came along just after NPR got up and running. And I imagine you take some pride in the growth and development of the idea of public radio and what that could mean to people.
Public radio's success, I think, depends on the news primarily. And that's really the backbone, the heart and soul of radio. There are other things, of course, but I think that the national shows are more popular than ever, and for very good reason. They're very well produced and well written. But I'm a little bit worried about small town public radio. Mm-hmm. I think that out in the middle of the country and out in Atchison, Kansas, and elsewhere, I think that's where public radio is really desperately needed. There are people who simply don't have much choice when it comes to radio, and public radio represents the mainstream out there. People who are involved in their communities, who are interested in the real world, and who want to hear about their neighbors, and I think that's what we're supposed to be doing.
You know, one of your recent newspaper columns, you suggested that you're confident that Lake Wobegon will survive President Trump, and that we all will. Some Democrats are probably wondering about that and how you can be so sure.
I wrote the column after the press gave so much attention to Scaramucci, the director of communications at the White House, who was, you know, a classic self-destructive person, and he came in and he blew himself up in about 10 days. But the press gave so much attention to this and to every tweet that comes out of the White House, as if these things were changing policy, as if these things affected people. And all I said in that column was that this is theatrics. Whether you like it, whether you despise it, it doesn't really change anything. And so I feel confident that we will survive. There is a body called the United States Senate. And the judiciary is alive and well, and so I think that people who bring up Germany in the 1930s are being terribly dramatic.
Before you go, just quickly, are you pleased with how the show has evolved now with Chris Thiele at the helm, and as you watch it go off without you?
I haven't been able to allow myself to listen to it. It's a complicated situation. I miss doing the show a lot, and so I simply have walked away from it. As the pastor of your church, you know, when he retires, is supposed to leave town and not go back and sit in the second pew. It's a good tradition.
You can't listen to it because it is it hard?
It would be if I listened to it, but I don't.
All right. Garrison Keillor's Love and Comedy Tour comes to Kansas City on Tuesday, August 29th. More information, uptowntheater.com. And Garrison, I miss you. It's so good to hear from you again, and we'll look forward to seeing you here in Kansas City.
Good to hear you. Thank you, Steve.
You bet. Bye-bye. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about organized crime in the aftermath of Tom Pendergast. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, University of Missouri System President Dr. Moon Troy shared his hopes and plans for higher education in the state and for UMKC's downtown campus for the arts. You can find that conversation online at kcur.org. Tomorrow we'll be in Basar, Kansas to talk wine with Doug Frost and Regional Vinters. That's tomorrow on KCUR is Up to Date. Well, following the death of political boss Tom Pendergast and the end of World War II, Kansas City's organized crime became very active and very violent. The result was one of the biggest hits in the history of the mob. Author Terrence O'Malley has written about how the Italian mafia managed to thrive in Kansas City in the post-war years, and he'll speak in town tonight. Terrence O'Malley is the author of Black Hand Straw Man, The History of Organized Crime in Kansas City, and he joins us now. And Terrence, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be here.
So what's the connection here, Terrence? Why did organized crime in this town become so active and so violent after Tom Pendergast died in 1945?
So Pendergast was indicted for and convicted of tax evasion in 1939. And so after that, there was what they called a clean sweep of the city. A lot of the civic leaders assumed power. That's when the police department went back to state control, and that's when they started enforcing the liquor laws and shutting down the bars and the clubs that were staying open till all hours of the evening.
And what was the impact on organized crime?
Well, the impact was fairly minimal, believe it or not. And the reason why is during the Pendergast era, organized crime had flourished so greatly here in Kansas City as opposed to other cities simply because the Pendergast machine was so liberal in its tolerance of organized crime and was specifically associated with organized crime when Johnny Lazzia kidnapped Pendergast poll workers in 1928 and threatened boss Pendergast that he would kill these guys if the Italians did not get political control over their own district. At that point in time, Tom and organized crime became connected to each other. And so all during the late 20s and all through the 1930s, organized crime became stronger and more pervasive in Kansas City. So when the political machine went down, the criminal syndicate did not go down.
It was too strong, too entrenched here in Kansas City, it
absolutely
sounds like.
And drugs were a huge part of it at that time, which I'm sorry to say, but unfortunately Kansas City was a major narcotics distribution hub during the 1930s and actually in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s until they had a prosecution in 1943.
Terrence, how did the Italian mafia gain a foothold in this town to begin with?
Well, it really starts just like it does for a lot of cities, and that was the Great Exodus from Italy from about 1900 to about 1920. And 66% of those Italians who came to Kansas City were from Sicily. And a lot of those people were obviously escaping the horrid mafia system that was in control over in Sicily. And so what happened was, instead of getting off the boats in New York and Boston, a lot of them came around and went to New Orleans. Then they took the Mississippi River up to St. Louis, and there were a ton of jobs in Kansas City. Kansas City was the largest city between here and Los Angeles and San Francisco until after World War II. So there were a lot of jobs to be here, so a lot of Italians came to Kansas City, and the criminal elements followed them.
You know, organized crime would wind up lingering in this town into the 1980s. I mean, that's some serious longevity here.
It really is. I mean, if you track the earliest origins of the Black Hand, which was the early Sicilian upon Sicilian extortionary period, it starts in about 1905. 1910 is really when the most serious documented cases begin. And then my book is called Black Hand Strawman. Well, Strawman was the code name that the FBI gave to the skimming of the casinos at Las Vegas. And the second Strawman trial was in 1986. So I always tell people it goes from about 1910 to 1986.
And today, any vestige of organized crime still in Kansas City?
If you talk to law enforcement, they'll tell you yes.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. The vestiges would be the way to put it. I think it's sporadic. I think it's nowhere near what it used to be. I tell people all the time, it'd be really hard to be a criminal in today's world. If you think about it, when they would go execute an assassination, a hit, they would go in and shoot somebody and then get into a stolen car, drive a few blocks away, and then throw off their stocking caps and get in another car and drive away. Well, all they'd have to do is pick up a hair sample from those stocking caps, and the DNA would nail these guys, but that wasn't in effect for years.
So it's tougher these days.
Oh, I would say a lot tougher, yeah.
When you say the mob became very violent in those years after Tom Pendergast sort of left the machine here, you're talking about what exactly? Was there a most violent moment?
There are several violent moments. And real quickly, before I get into that, let me just explain what they were doing during this period. Kansas City mob was flourishing with bookmaking, running a numbers racket called Policy, operating crap games, moving vast quantities of undetected booze, and transporting stolen goods on the black market. They were usually involved in cash businesses, such as arcades, pinball machines, jukeboxes, vending machines, and of course they were running bars and restaurants and other cash businesses, which gave them a veneer of legitimacy. So even though the political machine went down, all that stuff continued here in Kansas City. Huh. So what happens is you now have new leadership step to the fore in the form of Charlie Bonaggio. He was kind of the front man for the mob. And really, after World War II, things were very, very active in this town. And it goes all the way to the president of the United States, because Harry Truman became president in 1945. Well, in 1946, he was very upset with a local congressman named Roger Slaughter, and he wanted that guy purged from office. So he got hold of Jim Pendergast, who was Tom's nephew, who got in touch with Charlie Bonaggio, and together they ousted Roger Slaughter in the Democratic primary in August of 1946. Well, immediately the civic authorities cried foul over that election. And they convened a grand jury. They indicted some 50-plus people. But then in May of 1947, men broke into the Jackson County Courthouse at 3 o'clock in the morning and with nitroglycerin blew open the safe and stole all of the voting records so that they couldn't prosecute. And everybody said, well, that's Charlie Bonaggio is behind all of that. Well, there was a woman who was going to testify in exchange for the release of her husband. She had been participating in the fraudulent election. Well, she was running a fruit stand at 9th and Brooklyn. Her name was Mary Bono or Bonomo. And a car drove by and shotgunned her to death. So that's just one small example of violence. But they took over the Last Chance saloon which straddled State Line, Missouri and Kansas on Southwest Boulevard, which they literally had a diagonal line painted down the middle of the bar. And one side said Missouri, one side said Kansas. So when the cops from Missouri would raid, they'd just move all of the gambling tables and apparatus over to the Kansas side and vice versa. That went on for years. Well, the mob decided they wanted to own that bar. So they gave the owner of the bar a chance of saying, we want to buy it. He said no. And then they bombed, detonated bombs a couple of times to give him a message. He still said no. Well, after a while, they just executed him and said, you're done.
And there was a famous set of executions at that tavern.
Well, what happened was the night of April, I have to get my dates correct, but I believe it's April 5th, 1950, Charlie Benaggio and Charlie Gargatta were there at that bar.
Two men who were sort of competing to run the mob here in Kansas City.
That's right. Benaggio was generally considered the face of the mafia, and Charlie Benaggio was what you would call that thing, which is a notorious police character. He had an arrest record and conviction record that is the length of your arm. You know, he's just a really bad guy. Well, so these guys, they go over to the political club, which is on Truman Boulevard, and underneath a huge picture of Harry Truman and then Governor Forrest Smith, they apparently met with somebody that they knew, and they were executed mafia style. They were shot once in the head and then three times.
Was it there or at the tavern?
No, it was there at political headquarters, which made it all the more notorious because Harry Truman is president of the United States, and there's a mobster dead on the floor underneath a huge picture of Harry Truman. So howls of protest went out from Congress about the lawlessness of the president's own city, and it gave birth to the Kefauver Committee. And if you want to know what the Kefauver Committee is, if you know the movie The Godfather, where Michael Corleone is being grilled, that's the Kefauver Committee. And if you go to the Mob Museum out in Las Vegas, which I recommend everybody do because it's amazing and it's run by the same people who run the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland and the Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., so it's very well done. But you make your way up into the courtroom where they held the Kefauver Committee hearings in Las Vegas, and they show a film, and the first two murders they start with are Benaggio and Gargatta.
You know, it's just amazing hearing you talk about this, that this was happening in our town, you know, a number of years ago now, obviously, but you can hardly believe it.
Yeah.
Wide open this town was, how lawless it was.
Yeah. And I think that it just became part of our culture. People understood. I mean, I remember being a little kid, my dad driving by a pizza joint going, oh, yeah, the mafia owns that, you know.
Yeah.
It was just like, yeah, well, that's just the way it is, you know.
Are there vestiges of all of that today?
Well, I mean, I can hardly drive around this city without knowing exactly where a lot of these.
But you're an historian.
Yes.
How about for those of us who aren't? Are things different here today because the mob was so dominant back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s?
Well, it certainly colors our history a lot and makes our history perhaps, you know, a lot different from a lot of other cities. What I tell people all the time is for Kansas City's size, we had a disproportionate effect on the national syndicate. There was just so much going on here.
Wow, it's amazing. Well, if you have a question about organized crime in KC after the Pendergast era, give us a call, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR, up to date. I'm visiting with author Terrence O'Malley, author of Black Hand, Straw Man, The History of Organized Crime in Kansas City. He'll be speaking tonight on this topic. Do I have that right?
Yes.
At 7 at the Midwest Genealogy Center.
That's right.
That's at 3440 South Lee Summit Road out in Independence. I'll give that address out again a little bit later. But tonight at 7, Terrence O'Malley at the Midwest Genealogy Center. How did Kansas Cityans react to all this, Terrence? I mean, was there a lot of fear in this town?
Well, there certainly was among the Italian community because, very interesting, when organized crime started to congeal here in Kansas City, if you were a Sicilian Italian, then you had a lot of fear because you lived under that system. But if you were, say, from Milan or Venice, well, you hadn't lived under a mafia system. So you weren't as threatened by it as those who had actually lived under the oppression in Sicily. So
Right. When
they got over here and they started getting black hand letters, yeah, it was very serious. Now, the one thing I'm going to tell you about the Kansas City mob, and I think most of the police department and the FBI would agree, which is they basically kept it to themselves. Very few ancillary deaths throughout the whole era of the mafia. You don't hear a lot of innocent bystanders being victims of it in terms of being killed.
It was
that
very
sort
precise,
of thing.
Very targeted. You're saying.
And boy, in the 1970s and 80s, they were great arsonists. I mean, they detonated a lot of bombs, obviously in the River Key, bombs out in Vegas and other places, and they were just good at what they did.
Tell us about Nick Sevilla. He's one of the better known mobsters in town who dominated the scene for a bunch of years.
Yeah, and so. Those who have studied this subject, a lot of them believe that it was Nick Sevilla who was involved in the execution of Bonaggio and Gargatta, and that's how he made
his
bones.
That's how he ascended. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so he really comes on the scene, though, on the national scene, when they busted up the mafia confab at the Joseph Barbara estate in Apalachin, New York, where all the godfathers and dons from around the country had gathered, and there were all these black limousines outside of this guy's house in the middle of nowhere, and a state trooper thought that was odd and started running license plates, and they came to realize, my goodness, there's every mafia guy in the country here, you know, the leaders. And so also at that time were Joe Filardo, who ran the Roma Bakery, and Nick Sevilla were stopped up there and asked, what are you doing up here? And they said that they were up there chasing women. But in reality, what was happening was that Nick Sevilla was being introduced to the National Syndicate as the new head of everything in Kansas City.
Oh, that's interesting. Let's go to some calls here. Steve from Ottawa on the Kansas side. Steve, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I was just starting my so-called musical career in the early 70s and got a couple of gigs at just a couple of little bistros down in the River Key, which was the happening place at the time. I think it's a city market area now. But sometime after that, I guess that there was a lot of mob activity, places getting blown up and all, and it was derelict for a while. I just wanted to hear about that period of early mid-70s in the River Key. That was it.
Terrence, and the River Key, obviously a pair of words that a lot of our listeners will recognize because of what happened there.
Right. Just for the record, it's not very close to the river, and there really was no key. It was a marketing term that I think that the founder, Mr. Trezzolo, came up with. But so what was going on with the River Key was Kansas City was undergoing a urban renewal, and one of the things they did was where the Marriott Hotel is now in Kansas City on 12th Street.
Right.
Well, it used to be the vestige of the famous 12th Street drag in Kansas City, which at the time had, you know, maybe a couple hundred speakeasies around the city. But along 12th Street, there were still those old seedy bars, the Kit Kat Club and the burlesque shows and strip shows. And they were owned by the mob. They were owned by the Camisanos and other mobsters. Well, they needed a place to relocate. And so they wanted to relocate to the River Key, which was an up-and-coming urban entertainment center.
Right.
And there was resistance there, and the primary resistance came from the son of a mobster whose name was Freddie Bonadonna, and his father, David Bonadonna, was in the mob. And when Freddie Bonadonna resisted the strip clubs and the bars owned by the mafia, a war broke out there. And I'm simplifying, it's a complicated deal, but at the end of the day, what was amazing is that the mafia felt like they had to kill David Bonadonna, one of their own made members, because they knew if they killed Freddie Bonadonna, that David would come after them. So they killed David Bonadonna first, the father, and then they were going to go after Fred. But then Fred turned into a federal informant.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about loyalty and honor within the Kansas City mob, and what were some of the rules? What was permitted? What wasn't?
You know, in talking with...
Because this is a strong set of characteristics that dominated the mob.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that the notion of omerta, which is a conspiracy of silence among not just MAID members, but I think generally among the Italian community was very frustrating for law enforcement because really nobody talked about it. As a matter of fact, when my film came out, this is both a film and a book, you know, when my film came out, what I got from a lot of the Kansas City Italians was it kind of broke open the dam to allow them to start talking about a lot of things that had occurred in their cultural history. And so I think omerta was a very strong concept. Now, I think maybe over-publicized or over-glorified is this notion of if you go to prison, we're going to take care of your family. I think that probably would have been true at the upper echelon, but maybe not so much for the lower echelon. And I know you could talk with a lot of families that say they suffered a lot of hardship when, you know, their father or their family head went to prison. It wasn't that easy.
But again, this was sort of like a set of guiding principles here that kept these organizations, I guess, alive and moving forward for a lot of years.
Well, they were part of the National Syndicate, and the National Syndicate was a very real thing, and we were an important cog in the National Syndicate. In the 40s, 30s and 40s, we were an important cog because we were not only distributing booze illegally, but also narcotics illegally. Which is sad, but all you have to do, and in fact, I checked this with Chuck Haddock before I wrote my book and did the film, and that is that all you have to do is think of Charlie Parker. He was hopelessly addicted to heroin, mafia heroin, when he left Kansas City.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but what happened was there was this huge prosecution in 1943. They brought up the Antonori family out of Tampa. And they prosecuted about 10 mobsters. And after that, really, heroin and cocaine distribution was never the central focus of the mafia here in Kansas City.
Let's go to another phone call here. Jerry from Lee Summit. Jerry, good morning. We're talking about organized crime in Kansas City after Tom Pendergast, our guest author, Terrence O'Malley. Good morning.
Good morning. When I was in school back in the 70s, there was a hamburger place on Truce called Wimpy's, and it was owned by an Italian family, and I heard that it was a kind of a front for the mob, and then the family that owned it turned state's evidence or whatever against the mob, and they went into witness protection, and that's why Wimpy's is no more. And I was wondering if you've heard anything about that.
How about Wimpy's, the hamburger joint?
Yeah, Wimpy's was definitely, just like a lot of restaurants and bars in Kansas City, was a safe place for MAID Mafia guys to meet. As a matter of fact, there's some fascinating surveillance of Tuffy DeLuna, and I want to say maybe Cork Savella, but a couple other guys, maybe Muratina. They're talking about the fact they know they're going to go to prison. It's coming down. And it's just, hey, we know it's going to happen. This is the price we pay for leading the life that we lead. It's just a matter of doing business. But they start talking about, we're ready for it. We got more money than, I think they said, AT&T, you know. That they were ready to go. Planning on, you know, they knew they were going to get convicted, and that was that. And it was just a fascinating piece of surveillance to read about.
Well, Terrence O'Malley is the author of Black Hand, Straw Man, The History of Organized Crime in Kansas City. Again, he speaks this evening at 7 at the Midwest Genealogy Center. That address, 3440 South Lee Summit Road out in Independence. Terrence, you're such a fount of information about all this stuff. Thanks for coming in and sharing it with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
Let's get started right here. I'm leaving you.
tomorrow seems to me, girl, you know I've done all I can. Well, well, see a big stone I borrowed. Get better now. Yeah. Ooh, that's why I'm easy.
Well, look who's here. Brian McTavish wanted to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend, and that's the great Lionel Richie. I recognize that voice anywhere.
He makes it sound so
easy.
Yes, he does. And yeah. Richie will headline on a bill that includes Mariah Carey. Yeah.
It's amazing that she's not the headliner. I mean.
Well, I'm sure they came to some kind of
agreement.
Mutually lucrative agreement. Yeah. I mean, that's a great double bill,
it
right?
Is a great
that's
double
fantastic.
Bill.
That starts at 7 o'clock with yet another opener whose name now escapes me at the Sprint Center, 7 o'clock Sunday. You know, when Lionel Richie co-founded the Commodores way back in 1968, when we were but lads then.
Yeah,
he started out as the group's saxophone player.
Did not know that.
Yeah, there's some old funny video. It's not funny, haha, but funny like, wait, whoa, whoa. Is that
Lionel Richie?
Is that Lionel Richie? And he would contribute some vocals and he would pen some songs, but he really got the hit song engine going initially with the Commodores in the 1970s with songs like, I mean, and you don't associate this song with him, but Brick House.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote Brick House.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
He wrote not once, not twice, but three times a lady of
really?
Course. And, of course, Easy was actually a Commodores hit. And then later as a solo act in the 80s, bunches and bunches of hits. He's actually doing the All Hits Concert Tour. That's what it's called. All the hits. So that's what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And then some. But, you know, on his own, he did Hello, All Night Long,
yeah.
Dancing on the Ceiling. He had this 1980 duet with Diana Ross, Endless Love. I think people's hearts are still melting.
Huh.
They're endlessly in love.
That's
still
amazing.
Those two. Oh, it's amazing. But here... And this has slipped your mind, perhaps. Way back in 85, he co-wrote a not-so-little ditty with Michael Jackson. It was called We Are the World.
Oh, that's right, too. Yeah. So Lionel Richie is a man of great esteem in the musical community.
Yes, absolutely. Lots of Grammys and lots of other awards.
That's why he's the headliner, and Mariah's saying, maybe you go first.
Oh, the reporter in you. You want the answer? The answer is he's... Well, I don't know the answer, but my guess is that, sure, she headlines, he headlines, but together they can hit it out of the park. And if you put those two together, guess who's not going to take second billing? That's Lionel Richie.
Yeah, okay.
He's going to go on at the end of the show. So enjoy all the hits. I wonder if they'll do We Are the World. I would if I were him.
7 o'clock Sunday mm-hmm. at the Sprint Center.
One
What do we have here?
Groove. Sound pretty good to you?
Not bad.
A good groove.
Who is that?
That is Vintage Trouble. They actually hang out in the L.A. neighborhood of Laurel Canyon, which was also home long ago and far away to people like Joni Mitchell. And, Stephen Stills and lots of other people who sound nothing like this. But anyway, Vintage Trouble, they're the Saturday night headliner at the Paola, Kansas Roots Festival. Mm. And you get roots music from bluegrass to blues rock, and this is a bit of the blues rock. Plus, you get a barbecue cook-off. You got kids' games.
In Paola, Kansas.
Yes, in Paola, Kansas. The music starts at 5:30 Friday and 11 in the morning on Saturday. Once again, this is at Paola Park Square in Paola, Kansas. It's not too very far from here. And Stoney LaRue, he's the Friday night headliner. He's kind of a sturdy Texas troubadour. But you know what else you can see there?
No.
You can see the 1913 gazebo that's in the middle of the park. It's a centerpiece of the community in Paola, and that replaces the gazebo that was built like 50 or 60 years before 1913.
I'm told it's very nice there. Very lovely.
I'm told it's right. It is very lovely, and we should make the trip.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 happy things to do in Kansas City this weekend at kcur.org. Oh, I'm glad you're including this. That's our man, Charlie Parker.
Oh, yeah.
You recognize him anywhere.
How could we not include this?
How could we not? Right. It's a big weekend for Charlie Parker.
Oh, it is. This is the big weekend. I mean, the celebration goes on into next week. But we are in the midst of the annual Charlie Parker celebration. The late, great, innovative, stunning, amazingly talented, you name it, saxophonist. Let's see, what shall we focus on?
Let's talk about the 21 Sax Salute at noon on Saturday. I've long thought it's the quintessential Kansas City event.
Oh, yeah.
If you go to the Kansas City Jazz Ambassadors website, there'll be a little listing under events about how to find your way to Lincoln Cemetery just outside of town on the east side. That's the place to go to see the 21 Sax Salute where Charlie's buried.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's a wonderful event.
With your earlier fascinating guest who was talking about the local mafia years ago and how Charlie Parker got his fix, I guess.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, Charlie Parker, who grew up in Kansas City, obviously, he experienced his share of well-documented personal problems. Mm-hmm. But we're celebrating the music. We're celebrating the stuff that lives on, that makes 9-year-olds get up and 90-year-olds take their hand and dance with them. And that 21 Sax Salute will be fantastic. That's at noon on Saturday. And there's also a walking tour of the 18th and Vine Jazz
District. Chuck Haddix is going to do that morning, earlier that morning, at 9:30, I think.
Correct. Yeah. You're up on your jazz.
Why, of course I am.
You always are.
I am. Is that Harry Carey?
Of course.
Of course it is. Wow. Haven't heard that in a while.
I love him.
Old-fashioned baseball. Tell me about it.
Well, we're going to go back even before Harry Carey, the famed announcer of the Chicago Cubs.
Yeah.
We're going back to 1929. It's the Babe Ruth baseball event, played the 1920s way, when the Kansas City Men's Senior Baseball League goes old school. They'll stage a free game from 4 to 7 o'clock on Saturday, and this takes place at Herman Laird Park. And where is that? Well, that's just outside the gates of the Shawnee Town Museum at Johnson Drive and Cody Street.
And it was a different game back then.
Well, yes. Now, since they're invoking the name of Babe Ruth in this old-timey game from the 20s, I doubt that the members of the, I don't think the players are going to eat 20 or 30 hot dogs before they hit the mound, right? I don't think that's going to happen. But that's what the Babe did.
Okay.
He did it. It happened.
And finally today, these guys are actually going to be here, right?
They actually are going to be here.
They're going to be here.
It would be wrong if we said they were going to be here and they weren't, although stranger things have happened. That is Kool and the Gang, classic funk R&B band. I mean, 8 o'clock Friday, KC Life Stage downtown at the Kansas City Power and Light District. And they had other hits like Hollywood Swinging and Jungle Boogie. But Celebration, that 1980 breakout hit that, you know, they've got to play that every time because that's who they are. What occurs to me, I don't have a laundry list here, but that song, you've heard it, that has been used so many times in so many movies and TV shows, perhaps ironically, but not on Friday in Kansas City downtown. Celebrate with Kool and the Gang.
That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow's Friday, and we're celebrating with a trip to Holy Field Winery in Basar, Kansas, to talk with Master Sommelier Doug Frost and regional winemakers. You won't want to miss that. Denny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar produce our program. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.